figured I was gone, huh?
Run, hide in the staircase. Run quick. Ruby, shit. What do you want?
I want them kids.
I'm giving you to the count of three to get out of here. Then I'm coming across the kitchen shooting.
The combined powers of Paul Gregory and Charles Laughton brought The King Mutiny Court-Martial to Broadway. Now the screen receives that same creative, electrifying impact. The Night of the Hunter.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Holmes Movies Podcast. Hope everyone has been enjoying their scary movie month, or as we, or as normal people call it, October. I'm joined by Adam over Skype.
Hello.
Hello from the hills of Northampton.
Yes, the dark hills of Northampton. It's pitch black at the moment because it's early in the morning.
Early one morning as Adam was rising to record a podcast today.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I just popped into my head and I thought just doing that.
Quite cheerful, I suppose.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. It's grey here in Copenhagen, but it's got a good fall look or autumn look. It's good. Yeah, I had a Felina over here the last week. It was really good fun. We went to the aquarium, the Blue Planet, which was really nice.
Okay. Did you do anything scary?
Yeah, I did. I watched a bunch of horror movies. I saw a few. Most of them I hadn't actually seen before. I saw the French movie I'm going to butcher the pronunciation.
Le Diabolique.
Le Diabolique, yes, which was a wonderful film, very creepy. Oh,
so good.
It was the film that Alfred Hitchcock nearly did direct. He nearly got the rights to it, but the director of Le Diabolique, he actually got him the rights to do the film about 2 seconds before Alfred Hitchcock did.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, bugger. But you can kind of see how
Bastard got there first.
But you can kind of see, like, there's a bit of a psycho vibe around the film. I think that movie did probably inspire a little bit of Psycho, I think.
It's very Hitchcock. I mean, the plot is straight from, like, you know, you could imagine that as a Hitchcock film very easily.
Yeah.
It's totally in that vein. Isn't it by the guys who wrote the story that became Vertigo? Is that right?
Yeah, Hitchcock liked the film so much.
Narcissiac and the other one. I can't remember the names.
I'll just quickly look it up. But he did actually like their work so much, he did have them come up with...
He bought everything else they'd ever written.
he liked it so much, he had them write... He came up with the story of Vertigo, which came out in 1958.
And it's also a damn good movie, but The Diabolique is really good. And did you know that the actress, let's just say, to avoid giving any spoilers, but the main actress, not Simone
Signoret,
but the other one, actually did die of a heart attack in real life.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's really sad, but it's also like art imitating life.
But she was married to Henri Georges Clouzot, the director. Clouzot, the director of the movie, and he also directed her in the film La Vérité. And he fell into a deep depression over her death.
What were the writers called?
That was the reason why. It was Henri Georges Clouzot and Jérôme.
Oh, but I thought it was based on a...
It was based on a book by Pierre Boulot and Pierre Aho. I'm saying the names wrong, probably, but...
Maybe I got it wrong then.
No. They wrote the books and then Vertigo was adapted from that book. Yeah, we were right.
Okay, so I just got the names wrong. No matter. No, that's an incredible movie.
Yeah, really good film. Really creepy as well. And also just very atmospheric and just cool with tension and stuff. It's really nice.
Right. Well, I reckon you probably want to talk about some news.
Yeah, actually, before we get on to the other thing, I wanted to sort of bring up something that we talked about in the last episode. In the last episode where we were talking about Frankenstein, I mentioned a story about Boris Karloff wiggling his pinky to...
Yes.
I was slightly inaccurate about that. He actually didn't do it to the girl. He did it to the actress Mae West when he attacks her in the scene in the film, just to show that he was Boris Karloff and not Frankenstein's monster.
Mae West is in Frankenstein.
Wait, I've got the name wrong. What was her name?
I was going to say, you wiggle a pinky at Mae West, she's going to return fire. You know what I mean?
Mae Clark. Sorry, it's Mae Clark. Got my name wrong.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad that surfaced. That's resurfaced.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think before we get on to before we get on to the film that we are going to talk about, The Night of the Hunter, a certain trailer popped up online yesterday during Monday Night Football, and that was the final trailer to the final Star Wars film for a while, Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker, which I have to say, when I saw the trailer, it gave me chills, and also the line that C-3PO says, where he says, "Taking one last look at my friends." I got a little bit choked up because I thought it's going to be the last time that we see any of these characters, because if they're ever going to do a Star Wars film again, probably 5 or so years down the line, we're probably never going to see any of these legacy characters again. We're probably going to see some new people. So in some ways, this is a really big event. It's the last time to see any of these characters. It's their last stand. It's wrapping up the Skywalker storyline. We don't know what it is. I have some ideas of where things could go, but I'm not one of these people on the internet who's just dissecting the trailer and being like, this scene is this, this scene is that, this scene is this. I just want to like be as open-minded about the film and just go in blind and just be surprised as I was when I saw The Last Jedi. But what did you think of the trailer?
It made me nervous, honestly. I don't know. Firstly, I thought that C-3PO line, no matter where it comes, whether it's because C-3PO is going to quote-unquote die, or whether it's because they just want to put that line in as a... I feel like that line should not be used in a trailer. That's the kind of line you want to surprise audiences with in the moment, because that's a really... That is an emotional thing to say, and I think that like it... It gives too much. You don't need to give that much away. I feel like this trailer is giving a little bit too much away. It's obvious to me that there's some kind of descent into some sort of afterlife, or after, because you've got the Palpatine is there and the shell of the old Death Star, and I start to worry too much that this is getting a little bit that they're perhaps going to great lengths to try and bring in something that's already been, you know, Palpatine's already been concluded. You know, Palpatine isn't the entire personification of the Sith or the dark side or whatever it is. Mm. You know, I'm nervous about the idea of bringing him back. You know, the Death Star was blown to smithereens. He was thrown into the reactor core of the, you know, by Darth Vader. That was over. That was done. So I do not understand. I don't really fully understand how they're going to tie that in, and I don't get this. I wonder if Rey is going into some sort of weird, like half space, you know, some kind of strange, like not quite real place to sort of revisit these battles or whatever it is. They're going to have to do that really carefully. The scene, it looks like they're just going to pick up the scenes with her and Kylo Ren again, sort of where they left them off as well. And I hope they land that better, because rewatching The Last Jedi, you know, those scenes are really well done. Mm. And they set up a lot of tension in the movie, but that's also one of the things I found a little sort of narratively frustrating with The Last Jedi, was how the arc of Kylo doesn't quite make sense. Like he's sort of, you know, throughout the movie, he looks like he's coming back, and then he kills Snoke, but then he like doubles down and goes super dark, and it's like just that feels like that shift suddenly feels a little bit abrupt. And so I hope that if they're going to keep this tension going between him and Rey, that they really execute it well. So, and there was just aesthetically, I thought it looked a little bit more CGI-y, and I don't know, kind of not quite as it didn't have its head up as much as the first two, especially The Force Awakens. You know, with when you watch the trailer for The Force Awakens, it was all like big vistas and new worlds, and this one felt sort of somehow claustrophobic and one note, like the aesthetics of it seem very kind of washed out. And so I'm just
it's very shiny.
This I mean, it's not a. It's I joked about you via text that I was worried about it was going to be like another Return of the Jedi, but I don't think that's a problem that we need to worry about. I don't think they're going to throw a bunch of Ewoks and Jabba the Hutt at us.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
Exactly. I think what concerns me more is that they're going to go in a very serious and kind of high concept direction that isn't going to work. So that's what makes me nervous. But anyway, we'll see.
I can understand that. But yeah, it's in a couple of months, so we can...
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I'm sure we'll podcast about it. Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about the what's been in the news regarding Coppola and Scorsese slagging off the Marvel movies.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I've gotten so bored hearing people just going on about it online. I'm just done. I mean,
I fully agree with them. That's the thing. Everyone's like, these old crusties, they don't know what they're talking about. And then you have people being like, you know, the Marvel movies made so much more money. And it's like, well, firstly, pillock, money's not what...
Yeah.
You know, money's not the arbiter of good cinema, because otherwise Gone with the Wind would be the best film ever made. And B, adjusted for inflation, The Godfather's made more money than any of those fucking movies. So shut up.
Yeah, I know. Like someone online was like, those movies have made more money than their movies combined. I'm like, it's quality over quantity, you prick.
But also, this is a very valid concern. This sort of like army of Twitter nerds that has grabbed their pitchforks and marched on the 1970s.
Yeah.
Can just fuck off, because it's like, yes, this is what they're talking about is a very real thing, which is that a lot of films that come out these days are just garbage, and a lot of them aren't Marvel movies. They are, but the Marvel movies personify one of the things that is wrong with the current, you know, current filmmaking and what stops new and exciting films from happening. Films like the one we're going to talk about today do not get released as much as they should, because the space is crowded by franchises and remakes. And you know, Star Wars is part of that problem. James Bond is part of that problem. And Marvel, but the sheer just like avalanche of stuff that they put out. And yes, I'm sure there are some decent movies in there. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love what's it called? The Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever. And I don't watch the other ones because I find it incredibly boring. But like, you know, that's just personal taste as well. I get that. I get that there are people who enjoy them and love living in this moment, and comic book readers who finally are like, you know, this is like, you know, a kind of renaissance for them. But it's not good cinema. You know, it's not. And say what you want about Scorsese. I personally think that Scorsese and Coppola are a little bit not, like, overlauded, over deified in terms of filmmaking, because, you know, they have both made excellent, like, seminal movies. Yeah. Like, not just era-defining, but, like, art-defining movies. You know, like, The Godfather on the one hand, and Raging Bull and The Goodfellas. You know, they, don't get me wrong, they've also both made a lot of shite. Like...
Oh, yeah. If you look at, if you look at, like, Coppola's filmography post Apocalypse Now, it's very hit and miss for the most part. I mean, his company went bankrupt. He had to make Dracula and Godfather 3 just to keep the lights on.
Exactly. I mean, and anyone who makes Godfather 3 deserves all the pelters they get. But that's not to say, that they're wrong. I mean, it just is another expression of how the discussion on the internet is just completely completely stupid. And obviously there is this just general cultural And rightly, you know, there is a cultural kind of instinct to throw back in the faces the sort of pronouncements of old white men at the moment. So, you know.
Yeah, anyway. I know. I mean, I've just seen people that I follow on Twitter. I've not, like, I don't want to, like, go on a huge, like, tirades on Twitter because I just don't want to add more, you know, add to the pot, because I just try to avoid all that, because I feel like I would just rather talk about it in person with people rather than just throwing it out online. And, you know, a lot of people are just saying, like, they're just sounding petty and things like that. And it's like, they're allowed to have their opinions, and maybe they're a bit extreme, but it's their opinion. And, like...
It's not that extreme. Those films are shite. Like,
well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's an opinion. I mean, I've seen all the Marvel movies. I like a fair amount of them. I think some of them are actually very decent. And I think there's a few in there that I would say are actually pretty great films. Like... I would say Guardians of the Galaxy is a really great film because it felt very different, because it had, you know, it had a voice to it, which hadn't really been had before, because we already had all, like, the normal superheroes and things like that, like Iron Man, Thor, and this one was very different. It felt like, you know, before it was always, it's like the Beatles, and then the Rolling Stones came along, and then it was kind of cool and interesting, and it was fun. And, like...
Well, let's be honest, you know, the Beatles and the Stones in this conversation are Coppola and Scorsese.
Yeah.
You know, a film like Guardians of the Galaxy is like Herman's Hermit compared to them, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and this is the thing, you know, you say it's a great film. It's a great film within the parameters of that kind of movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, you know, The Godfather, let's be very clear about this, is a great film within the parameters of all of cinema, taken from the moment that the Lumiere brothers filmed workers leaving their factory to the last... whatever poxy Marvel movie just got released in the cinema, you know, like, internet. I just think that it's a very clear distinction needs to be made. And I think there is a sense from all these, you know, pathetic nerds on Twitter that that they know, you know, the Emperor has no clothes. Like, these films are crap, and they know that, and that's kind of what irritates them, that whatever defines, you know, that to them, what defines this cultural moment, these movies, is... You know, it's candy floss. It's total
theme parks
ephemeral nonsense, and it will not endure the way that Coppola and Scorsese's best movies have. Anyway, those are my thoughts on it. I don't want to get in trouble with
Well, don't worry about that. We won't give them your address, but. but anyway, there was a guy.
Maybe I won't read out my social media details on this episode.
Just be like, yeah, fuck you. No, but there was a guy online, Chris Stuckman, who has his own YouTube channel, and he reviews films. And I actually really like his reviews. A lot of his reviews of films that I've watched, I actually agree with a lot of what he says, and he's really quite intelligent about the way he critiques films, better than most YouTubers that, you know, have their sort of pages and stuff. Like, He said, like, on Twitter, and I did retweet that because I thought it made sense, and it was like, for journalists asking Scorsese and Coppola all these questions about Marvel movies, maybe not ask them what you feel about Marvel movies, maybe talk about the way that cinema is at the moment and how hard it is for people like you guys to get your films made. Because if you look at his new film, The Irishman, which is finally coming out, and I'm so excited about it, I finished reading the book I Heard You Paint Houses a few days ago, and it's so good, and I just want to watch that film now. That took years for that movie to get made, and like, it's incredible that it's like a once in a lifetime film to have Scorsese, Joe Pesci, Harvey Keitel, Robert De Niro, Pacino making a film together, because you probably won't get those guys in the same project again. And that for me, will probably. I think that's the one film that I've been looking forward to this whole year over any Marvel movie or comic book movie that's come out, like, this year.
And of course, the truth of the fact is that, because if you do make The Godfather, if you make Raging Bull, if you make Taxi Driver, you earn the right to make whatever you want. Hence why we get Shutter Island and all the other and Dracula and God knows what other crap movies they've made. But, like, you know what? They're allowed to make those. They've earned it.
Yeah.
The only thing Marvel movies have earned is a shitload of money for a huge company that also is, you know, is not brilliant. You know, the guy who runs Marvel, for example, donates to Trump. I'm not saying that invalidates the movies. I'm just saying, like, let's get off our high horses here and talk about what actually contributes in a meaningful way to cinema. And yes, I sound like a snob. I don't give a fuck. Like, it is, that's the conversation that needs to be had here. And yeah, absolutely, the journalists asking these, the muckraking journalists deserve a huge portion of the blame. And I think perhaps there is a better conversation to be had about whether or not the Marvel movies are quote unquote good. I can have my provocative opinion. That's fine. But like, as you say, there is a conversation to be had that actually you and I have been having for a long time on this podcast about the direction of cinema. But I think actually this leads in rather neatly to our film that we're talking about.
Yes, the film that we're going to be talking about is Charles Laughton's film. The only film that the actor Charles Laughton, he was an actor before, he directed this film. It was the first and only film he actually directed, which I find to be quite tragic because...
Very sad.
This is a very well-directed film that shows that he has a real idea and eye for light, for camera, for setting, tension, and also, more importantly, acting. And it is, this is, like, a lot of the actors on this film have said this is one of their favorite experiences that they've had making a film. And the cinematographer, Stanley Cortez, who worked on Shock Corridor, the Samuel Fuller film, and also the Magnificent Ambersons, he said that the two directors that he worked with that understood light and respected it were Orson Welles and Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
The film was Night of the Hunter. It was released in 1955, and it stars Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters, who else is in the film? Lillian Gish,
of course.
James Gleason and Billy Chapin and Sally Jane Bruce as John and Pearl Harper, who the plot of the film is their father comes back to their house. He is just he's got a lot of money that he stole, and then he hides it somewhere with and the children are sworn not to tell anyone where it is. And then he goes to prison, and while he's in prison, his cellmate is a reverend who also happens to be a serial killer, played by Robert Mitchum.
Harry Powell.
Yes, and Harry Powell is a very, very, very scary man.
So the basic plot, of course, is that, as you say, that Ben Harper, played by Peter Graves, of course, who is most famous for playing the pilot in Airplane. Do you like wrestling movies?
Oh, is that him?
Yeah.
Is that him?
Yes.
Oh my God, yeah. I didn't know that. I was wondering who that guy was, because I was like, who is he? I know I've seen him before.
He's a wonderful character actor. He's in a bunch of stuff. He's in Stalag 13 as well.
You say 13 or 17?
Stalag 17. Oops, yeah. Excuse me.
So he's at 13.
he's hung and then Robert Mitchum finds out where he was living, goes back. He seduces and marries Willa, his widow, played by Shelley Winters, and becomes a sort of nightmare stepfather for the two kids the only people who know where the money is.
Yes.
And then he kills Willa. He chases the children, who finally find refuge with Miss Cooper, who's played by Lillian Gish, and she sort of saves them. She provides their salvation. So that's the basic plot of the movie. But I think we need to talk about why. I mean, this is one of my favorite films, and I want to really speak to you a lot about what makes it singular, what makes it stand out. And I think we can start by, you mentioned Cortez, and I think visuals are one of the key components here. I mean, the black and white cinematography in this movie is astonishing, and it's so great because it is this. It's like that. It doesn't feel like a film from 1955 in the way it's shot.
No, it doesn't.
It feels like the 1940s by way, like film noir by way of German Expressionism and Orson Welles.
Yeah,
like Stanley Cortez had done Ambersons for Welles, which is just a great movie. The way light and shadow and sort of the way that the set design even is used in this film, I think has such a debt to films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu and Metropolis and things like that, which are just, you know, which really give it this sense of, it's almost like a silent movie that's been brought to that's learned to speak, you know, and I just, it's captivating because of that, and also completely new. Despite being kind of old.
The way I sort of looked at it, I watched it last night, and I looked at it in like, it's a southern gothic tale by way of Brothers Grimm, because it feels like a modern, for that time, a modern fairy tale. I think Charles Laughton described it as like a dark Mother Goose tale.
Well, so visuals aside, so the plot, the writing is, it is, it was from the novel by Davis Grubb, which was published in 1919.
Yeah, I've read the book. It's actually really good.
The film is set in
West Virginia, 1930s.
West Virginia or somewhere. And then it's set during the Depression. So it's set a little bit earlier than the 50s.
Mm.
And yeah, it is a fairy tale. It is a total, it feels like some kind of, a true story, like a picture book story for children that's leapt onto the page, because the children at the center are always at the center of the, except for a couple of moments, are always at the center of the story.
We see the film.
That James Agee is credited as the writer on it.
Yeah, Charles Laughton is uncredited as well, I think.
But according to Elsa Lanchester, who of course was the bride of Frankenstein and also the bride of Charles Laughton, Agee came to stay with them to write the script, but he was just like drunk the whole time and was dying at that point.
Yeah.
And so what he turned in was just like unusable. So so Laughton pretty much wrote the whole thing himself. But what's really interesting, I actually did research for a change because I love this movie so much.
Yeah.
Laughton went to visit Davis Grubb after he first bought the rights to the movie.
Yeah.
And he had Grubb draw characters, sets, settings, scenes for him, which I'd love to see those drawings. I wonder where they are, if they even exist. And basically you have some storyboarding the film.
That's pretty cool. I like that,
which I think is really great. And so this plot sort of comes in, and I think this is also where the influence of silent cinema is apparent in the plot, because it feels kind of hokey in some ways, almost. And it has this sort of pastorality, this kind of, sort of mythic quality that really seems to belong in silent cinema. And I think D.W. Griffith is a big influence, and having Lillian Gish in the film is the thing that ties this movie to the silent era, because she was the great muse for Griffith.
Mm.
And it's interesting, actually. I read that Elsa Lanchester was supposed to play her part, or was considered to play her part. To get Gish is amazing. To be able to watch her at that age, you know, delivering a sound performance is a real treat. I mean, I know she'd done other stuff, and she would crop up again and again, just sort of doing a film every once in a while. But this, aside from her work in the silent era, this has to go down as one of her great roles.
Yeah. But it's also interesting looking at like the people that Laughton considered before Robert Mitchum, one of which was the good man Gary Cooper, who did not accept the role because he thought it would, you know, ruin his image on the screen as the good guy.
Yeah, I mean it's the part can really only be played by Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, and I can't see anyone else playing him and stuff. I mean, they also had Laurence Olivier and John Carradine. They both expressed interest in the role, but I think Robert Mitchum he just attacks that role, and he is just so good. And I think that I think this, I mean, I've seen a lot of films with him, and I think this is my number one favorite Robert Mitchum performance, and it's up there with his performance.
Has to be.
It's up there with him and Max Cady from Cape Fear, which is also, he plays a almost slightly similar character, although a little bit more southern.
Well, also a little bit more kind of cartoonish. Well, if it's possible to be more cartoonish than Harry Potter. But this is interesting because, you know, Mitchum at this point is just, he's fresh from his famous marijuana bust. He spent a little bit of time in prison. He's got his bad boy image, and I think both him and Lawton are kind of non-mainstream. I think Lawton sort of saw them as kindred spirits. And what I think is great is that you can totally believe Mitchum as a killer, but you can also believe him as a seducer. And, you know, he's both handsome and terrifying in this movie in ways that I think it would have been, you know, if you'd cast John Carradine, he would have been, yeah, fine. He was, would have been creepy, but could he have been as, like, he's got to have that sugary charm that Mitchum also has, you know, the way he kind of comes into the community and has everyone wrapped, except of course
the kids,
young John, wrapped around wrapped around his little finger. So
I just wanted to, like, talk about the kids a little bit, because I feel, I love how the film, because I think when you do films like this, you got to choose which perspective you have to shoot it from. And I think it's great that Lawton shoots from the perspective of the children. So we see the film through the children's eye, apart from a few other scenes in the film. And I love, like, it is a dark Mother Goose tale, because, you know, these kids, they immediately, well, John, he immediately sees who Harry Powell is, and everyone else just sees him as, like, a singing, you know, lovely preacher, when, you know, he knows that he is a bad guy and is trying to tell, you know, the innocent Pearl that, you know, we got to get away from him.
Yeah, I mean, the kids are it's really important, as you say, that decision. Interestingly, Lawton didn't really like working with them,
and I think he liked Billy Chapin. He didn't really like the girl that much, because she wouldn't, I think they used a lot of outtakes with her, because they, a lot of the time, I think Robert Mitchum ended up directing a lot of those scenes.
Yeah, that's what I read. Sally Jane Bruce is her name. Billy Chapin was a child actor. He's in another great movie called Violent Saturday, where he plays Victor Mature's son.
I have not seen that.
He died not long ago, actually. He died in 2016, that terrible year for people. I don't know if we covered it on that. You know,
yeah, we did. I think
Bowie and all those people.
Yeah, we did. We did talk about that. Yeah.
But he's very good, and he's very, very good. He really carries, you know, that, because you need someone with who's capable of delivering a performance, and he's very sort of mature and incredibly sweet too. I think the scenes with him and Lily and Gish are so moving at the end of the film.
Yeah,
where, like, they've lost everything, and she gives them a new life and a family, basically.
The children will endure.
Yeah, she's so good. I also, speaking of the cast, I really want to talk about Evelyn Vardin, who plays the ice cream parlor proprietress.
Yeah, she's great.
Mr. Powell. She's such, like, awful busybody, isn't she?
Yeah,
like,
I just,
that character's, and her, like, henpecked husband, who's played by Don Beddoe, like, such good characters.
But also James Gleason, who plays Uncle Birdie, who is practically the only friend that John Harper has, and he does say to him, you know, if you are in any trouble, you can always come to me for help. And then what happens? He gets drunk, and then the kids have to fend for themselves.
Yeah, it's no fucking help at all. And that's the thing. You know, this film for John is a succession of adults letting him down. His mother even lets him down by marrying this man, and dies. You know, and the only adult in the film who is any kind of friend to them is Miss Cooper. That wonderful moment where we first meet Uncle Birdie, it's like straight out of Mark Twain. Talk about fairy tale, you know, when the steamboat's coming down the river and they're waving at it and the music's really going, and it's like, wow, we're really in the pastoral kind of Americana here.
Yeah, we are.
But of course, then I think it's Birdie, his link to the river and his life down there in the shack that really provides us with one of the great kind of enduring images of the film, which is the the body of Willa Harper sitting in the car underwater with the weeds kind of
yeah, that's a very
around the sea, the riverbed, the, you know, whatever it is, the vegetation.
Such a nightmarish scene. It's so creepy as well, just with the water and the weeds all floating around and stuff, and the car's just there and her body, and you can see that she's had her neck slit open a little bit and stuff. I was watching it again. I just realized that that's such a like unnerving scene, and it plays off really well. And I feel like that scene inspired one scene in The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen Brothers film.
Yeah.
Where they find John Polito's character in the bottom of, towards the end of the film.
Absolutely. I think that I would not be surprised if that was a direct reference. I mean, but that, and that obviously makes Uncle Birdie get drunk this bit, but that, just having that visual, that shot is just, it's so amazing. But there, what are, some of the other ones I want to talk about, the first one of when we first see the preacher standing outside the house under the lamp.
Yeah.
I think that's great. And just that, where you just look out and it's like this perfect expressionist film set with the, you know, cardboard cutout practically, you know, backdrop with the harsh lighting, you know, practically shadows practically painted on, you know.
Yeah.
And then the other scene that I loved partly for its artificiality is when the children are fleeing the preacher in the boat and they land at that strange house, which is this sort of, you know, this kind of minimalist sort of monolith with this one window in it. It's like a stage set, you know, it's straight out of Caligari, and you have the canary, and then you hear that voice singing and you're like, oh, is this going to be their
salvation?
And obviously they don't go to the house, they go to the barn, but I just love that shot of the house and barn with the singing, with the silhouette of the bird cage.
It's a really
such
moving
an original
scene.
Image. It's such a wonderful kind of, I can picture it perfectly in my mind.
But the other great shot in following on from that scene is when they're sleeping in the barn. And in the foreground there's a hill, and then you start hearing Robert Mitchum singing "Leaning on the Everlasting Arms" as he's riding the horse. And
speaking of Coen Brothers references, of course they use that hymn in their remake of True Grit.
Yeah, and that is just a very creepy scene. You just hear him singing, and he's like the epitome of death. He's just riding a pale horse, basically, and singing a nice Christian tune. And I read on IMDb, apparently it was just a midget on a pony, but they just made it seem like they shot it from a different perspective to make it seem, you know, like it was Robert Mitchum, which I thought was quite interesting.
Robert Midget.
Yeah. Robert Mini-Me.
I think, is it Little Person?
I think Little Person, yeah.
Yeah, apologies.
But no, that's a great moment. And also just the lack of music in that scene, it just feels really tense just seeing him react to the horse riding on the hill and seeing him just slowly close by like the big bad wolf from the Three Little Pigs. And I just really like it. Yeah, such a really nice shot. And also the bit before he kills Willa off screen, but like the lead up to it, there's that great shot with where she's in the bed and she's lying like some, you know, like she's about to be put off to her funeral, very much. Well, and like the sort of like just the light that comes crashing in, and it's very, very reminiscent of German expressionism cinema.
But also the way that film, that scene is acted, it's so like it's sort of slow, and his performance is quite mannered in that moment, like that bit where he sort of, Mitchum like lifts his hand up to the sky and sort of looks at it in the light, and then when he comes to kill her, he sort of does it in almost in slow motion, and then obviously the cuts to the next scene.
Also that scene in the basement when he's going up the stairs and he's got his hands out like he's Frankenstein or something like that. He's just monstrous in that moment when he's just going
that's
after the children.
There's that scene in the basement, and there's a couple of scenes with him where, and it's interesting, this is one of the areas I think that divides opinion on the film, and certainly divided critical opinion at the time, is where there's like a sort of sense that it's almost a little bit farcical, that they play some of the scary stuff for laughs, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
Partly because Mitchum pulls it off with such panache.
Yeah.
But what I don't know, what do you think about that?
I think it plays off very well. I don't think it's humorous in any kind of way.
Well, it is. I mean, I think there are bits that are.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's not like, but it's humorous, but not like, it's not, I think the tone is set pretty well, so it's not supposed to be comedic at all. It might be seen as a bit ridiculous and everything, but I feel like if you showed this to a 21st century audience member who was really big on Marvel movies, they would probably laugh at that. What? They would probably laugh at that scene and be like, this is scary. Why?
Yeah, but kind of we've already talked about those people are idiots. I think that there is a, that it's funny because I think people at the time, you know, the film didn't do well. It had a decidedly mixed critical response, probably quite a negative one. And a lot of people just wrote like, it's not funny enough to be a comedy. It's not scary enough to be a horror film. What is this movie?
Yeah.
And that, you know, that broke Charles Laughton Hart, and he never made another one. But
oh, he went back to theater.
Before we talk about that, I wanted to speak about music by Walter Schumann, which is really good.
The music's really nice. The Pretty Fly song when they're in the boat, where
Pretty Fly for a Jedi.
where there once was a pretty fly. Pearl is singing, but she's dubbed by an actress that is tremendously older than her, Betty Benson. I love that scene. I thought that was really nice. It really kind of
the little kid starts singing, sounds like fucking Nico. Like, Once there was a fly.
I love that scene because it always felt like a real palate cleanser from all the horror you saw before in Robert Mitchum going into the water and then screaming like a child who didn't get his,
like a banshee.
Yeah, like a child who didn't get his present at Christmas or something.
I feel like it's more like a primal scream than that. It's like a sort of animal kind
animalistic
of howl, more like, you know. It really is. It's true. First time I watched that, I was genuinely quite terrified.
But just the way he says children, just that is terrifying enough.
It's straight. The Chilli Bang Bang, the child catcher. You know.
Yeah. Come here, children. Come and get your lollipop. Yeah.
That's so good. The music is just tremendous throughout. The way he weaves in folk and folk songs and hymns, you know. I wanted to mention my friend. Our friend Ed Randall.
Yes.
Did a great arrangement of the Dream Little One Dream. And once there was flies of in the same, he has this jazz quartet.
Yeah, the Swingle Sisters or whatever they're called.
No, not the Swingle Singers. He has a jazz thing that he did. He does as well. He has done. He has performed with his own quartet, and they did an arrangement of the music with these two songs sort of mixed together in one song, which was really good. And so,
I really want to listen to that.
I don't know. He's got an EP coming out actually, but I don't know that if this would be on it. But I thought it was just such a great. It is such a captivating score, and I'm not surprised that Ed as a musician kind of picked it up. But the music sort of has, you know, it's not exactly subtle in certain parts, you know, when the train carrying power is crossing the landscape, it's literally dum 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 dum.
Yeah, it's like everything's joyful, like and then every time Robert Mitchum's on the screen, it's like boom boom, like he's riding the horse or like driving the car. And like with the scene when you first see Harry Powell when he's driving the car, he's driving it in a really weird way, he's holding like the inside of it when he's not like on the outside of the wheel. I always find that really weird the way he drives the car.
That first scene with him is quite something because of the way he's sort of talking to God in this, you know, and you're aware of the fact that Mitchum's really leaning into this role and really he's really acting, but he's also being Robert Mitchum, and which is, you know, if there is a Mitchum style of acting, it is just be Mitchum. And his the conversation with God is very, it's like, yes, if Robert Mitchum was talking to God, this is probably how he'd do it. But he just adds this little twist of madness so well to the character, that sort of curled lip and the sort of that meanness that he was capable of in his performances is just so apparent. Mm. And I love the bit when it cuts to him at the strip show or the burlesque show.
Yeah.
And then you see this very phallic, like, the knife the coming pen through knife the coming trousers, out of like he's got a boner or something. You know, it's like, it's very, it's so, and his face in that scene is just such a picture of like lunacy.
Like hatred. I was thinking a little bit of like Telly Savalas' character from The Dirty Dozen a little bit, because he was also...
Yeah, a woman-hating, you know, like misogynist murderer. Like, it is a... Yeah, there's something... And there's something just awful about it. You really learn to despise this character because of the way that he treats women. I think that the a modern film, I dread to think of anyone ever remaking this, but a modern film would perhaps emphasize that a bit more. But the
yeah, I think the they
scene,
keep it quite.
The scene on their wedding night, for example, when he finally marries Willa, and then she's thinking, right, we're going to get down to it, because he has been seducing her in a pretty overt way. And then he's like, look at yourself, you're disgusting, like, da-da-da-da, we're never going to have sex, basically. And it just, like, destroys her. It's actually devastating.
And he brainwashes
such a,
her.
Such a horrible, nasty trick to play on someone. That, yeah. And then, of course, he murders her, so it's just like...
Yeah, right, he makes her, like, he makes her go to some Bible, like, venue.
Tent meeting, that's so cool, that bit. Yeah. The rubber!
I think like so. I think there's certain things that work very well in horror, and I think that's using religion in some sort of way that makes it kind of creepy. I don't know why, like certain films that like, do it very well. I think.
Well, this film reminds me a little bit of the first series of True Detective as well.
Yeah,
that, sort of, that milieu is very apparent. But what? So I mean, if it's a film in three acts, in some ways, you know, you've got the first bit with the, you know, the father going away and getting hung, and then the establishment of the Harry Powell in the community, then there's the murder and the chase. That's the second act. And the third act is interesting, because the third act tonally is so different, because you get their rescue by Miss Cooper, and they live near this town, and she has all these other kids in her care, including Ruby, who obviously, you know, she's tempted by boys and she gets into bad situations and also falls under Harry Powell's spell at one point.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is at the end of the film, when he's apprehended, a couple of things happen. Like he's been terrorizing them, and he's, you know, been threatening to kill them all. And it's like, you know, it's pretty vile, but in the moment that he's captured, John can't bear it and like gives him the money, you know, just says, you know, take it, like it's not worth it, like if you really want all this money, like for God's sake, here it is. And then in the trial, you know, there's a lynch mob essentially, and obviously I want to use that word very carefully, because we're talking in
step
the day after
lightly.
The president of the United States just referred to himself as getting lynched, which, you know, let's be clear about this, this is not, but this is a, you know, there's a mob coming for this guy, and then the hangman, who at the beginning of the film was like, ugh, I didn't like pulling the, you know, the lever on that guy, is now like, I can't wait to hang this motherfucker, and
I'll be first in line.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, da, 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 da. And it sort of paints this horrible, like, there's just this little sort of bitter end note here where it's not about, it's like there's a tragedy, and there's a, you know, it's like there's just a little kind of lesson, if you want to learn it, in there about how and why Harry Powell and people like him happen. It's because society is violent, society is cruel, and society is the mob. And which is also a Hitchcockian idea. And then we go back away from that. And there's that scene where Miss Cooper kind of leads the children, like a little row of ducks.
Yeah, it's like she's trying
town.
To retain their innocence. She doesn't want them to see.
Yeah. She takes them away from all of that into this kind of fairy tale. You know, she lives in a candy house, you know, a gingerbread house, essentially. And then they have Christmas together. And it's just the most sweet scene, and then she has that monologue at the end about the children enduring, and it's delightful. And it gets a little bit Frank Capra there, but hey, like, you know, it's like, what a wonderful moral,
yeah,
what a wonderful little, and I think that the I think the Night of the Hunter, it's like, if you go into it wearing any kind of irony around you, as any kind of protective armor, you're not going to enjoy it as much as if you just go in kind of wide-eyed and ready to be surprised and with a certain amount of curiosity.
I think that I completely agree with that. I also wanted to bring up this quote that Charles Laughton said when Lillian Gish asked him why you wanted me to be in this film. And he said, "When I first went to the movies, they sat in their seats straight and leaned forward. Now they slump down with their heads back and eat candy and popcorn. I want them to sit up straight again."
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it? Such a perfect motive for making a film.
Yeah.
Can I read you a quote that I found, actually, now that we're bandying about quotes, from David Thompson, who's one of the great, you know, film writers of our time. He says, of Night of the Hunter, he said, "No, of course it doesn't look or feel like an American film of 1955, but at that moment, it was essential that some movies begin to do things differently. The Night of the Hunter is not just a great film, it is among the great expressions of America's sense of childhood giving way to warped adulthood. Everything that was quote-unquote wrong about it was right, because an artist had perceived the work as a whole and brought it home. It was the public that was wrong, and no condition is more alarming." Speaking of what we were talking about before.
Yeah, no, I think both those quotes speak, I mean, for that period as well, but also...
I think we chose the right episode to have the discussion.
I think so too. I think we did very well.
Go see this film, please.
It's on Blu-ray. You can get it. If you have iTunes, you can just rent it on there. It's fine. You can just watch it there.
It's incredible. It's a monument to a certain kind of filmmaking. It's a great piece of Charles Laughton's legacy. Charles Laughton, who, you know, of course, is rightly remembered as one of the great character actors of his time.
Yeah. Have you forgotten about the House of Pain?
Yes, of course. The Island of Lost Souls. He died 7 years later, and he didn't direct another film. Perhaps he could have managed to squeeze in a couple more in the time that was left to him. But I think one of our last views of him is in Spartacus, where he plays one of those old senators, and he's just incredible in it. It's a shame that we never got to see the follow up. But there's something kind of, you know, when you take a step back from that sadness, there is also something wonderful about the fact that Night of the Hunter is just a one shot deal. Nothing comes before, nothing comes after. It's just the movie, and I feel like that has a certain romance to it. If you want to add a little bit of different of a flavor into your scary movie month, go see it, watch it, rent it, stream it, buy it preferably, and own it, and read about it and enjoy it. There's a great BFI series on, you know, those little monographs about films that the BFI released. There's a really wonderful one about the Night of the Hunter.
Didn't Simon Callow write it?
He may have done. I have a copy and I lost it. Do you have it?
I don't know. I don't. I might do here.
Anyway,
I do not know. But I have another quote that Daniel Day-Lewis cited Laughton as one of his inspirations, and he said he was probably the greatest film actor who came from that period of time. He had something quite remarkable, his generosity as an actor. He fed himself into that work. As an actor, you cannot take your eyes off of him.
That's true. Anyone who's interested in watching Charles Laughton strut his stuff should watch Witness for the Prosecution, which also features Elsa Lanchester. And is a really fun film.
Yeah, and he was the woman that he married from 1929 and up until his death in 1962.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Night of the Hunter, it's my favorite film, one of my favorite films. It's 5 stars, everything else, throw all the, you know, call me old-fashioned, call me whatever you want, but... it will clean the floor with anything Marvel's any overproduced, and actually it's kind of an insult to even mention those two things in the same sentence. But before I get in trouble, should we talk about birthdays?
Birthdays, yeah. Let's talk about birthdays. Happy birthday, top of the list. Daenerys Targaryen, Emilia Clarke,
Game of Thrones, go away, Game of Thrones.
Yeah, she's got a new film coming out, Last Christmas, directed by Paul Feig and co-written by Emma Thompson, who also stars in the film.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart.
It's based on
King's Landing.
It's based around the George Michael Christmas song.
Well, I obviously can't wait to watch this movie.
Happy birthday to Deadpool himself, Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, he's awful.
You don't like
him? He's genuinely one of my least favorite actors. He's so boring. What was that awful film about the Klimt painting with Helen Mirren was playing that Austrian woman?
Woman in Gold.
He's so bland. He's like Jim Gavin or something. James Gavin. You know, the John Gavin, the guy from Psycho.
Yeah.
James Gavin is general of paratroopers in the Second World War. Anyway. He's rubbish actor.
He's in a new film coming out in December, which is going to be shown on Netflix, and it's called Six Underground, and it's written by the writers from Deadpool and Zombieland, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, and it's directed by action filmmaker Michael Bay.
Oh my god.
Happy birthday to Andy McDowell's daughter, Margaret Qualley, who recently was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and she played one of the Manson girls.
Right.
She's good in the film.
Okay. Is anyone actually decent born today?
happy birthday to director Ang Lee.
Oh, he's quite good.
Yeah, he's very good.
He did Sense and Sensibility, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he also did Brokeback Mountain, which is a really...
which, you know, I still haven't seen.
It's a very good film. It's very... it's a great film. Heath Ledger is just amazing in that film. He should have got the Oscar. But, I mean, maybe he could have divided it with Philip Seymour Hoffman for Capote, but yeah, I don't know.
Heath Ledger was an amazing actor. Sam Raimi, I've just brought up the birthday here as well. You must enjoy him.
Oh, yes, I do, and he's about to make a new horror film at some point, which I'm really excited about. He hasn't directed a movie since 2009, which was the very... He hasn't made a horror film since 2009, which was the film Drag Me to Hell, which is just great. And he's been producing a lot of films. He did produce one film that I watched recently called Don't Breathe, which is about three burglars who go into a blind man's house to steal his money, and then they realize that we just broke into the wrong house. And getting in is easy, but getting out is hard. Happy birthday to country western star Dwight Yoakam, who also is an actor and has played in many films, and he is fantastic in Billy Bob Thornton's film Sling Blade, which he also stars in as well, and won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay.
He's great. I love his music too.
Yeah, I can't. Guitars and Cadillacs. I can't help listening to that song and not going, "I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle."
Jesus. Diana Dawes, one of the British sort of screen sirens, was born on this day. But I just wanted to, I was just looking her up here because she wasn't born Diana Dawes. She was actually born Diana May Fluck. And I see why maybe they changed her name there.
Yeah, I can understand that, yeah. Happy birthday to Johnny Carson, the legendary king of late night TV.
Oh yeah, of course.
Happy birthday to Weird Al Yankovic, who is, you know, a funny man. Happy birthday.
Oh, and Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton's birthday.
Hugh Fraser, who's famous for playing in Poirot, but he's in a bunch of those Sharp. He plays Wellington in a bunch of the Sharp films.
He's also the traitor in Patriot Games.
Yes, of course.
Happy birthday to Philip Kaufman or Kaufman, who wrote the screenplay for the right stuff.
Oh yes, of course.
And directed Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Donald Sutherland, and also I think is credited as a story. He wrote the story of Raiders of the Lost Ark with George Lucas, and he wrote the screenplay for The Outlaw Josie Wales.
Whoa. Okay.
So you know he's done some stuff.
Oh my God, Anders, it's Una O'Connor's birthday today, the character from the one who plays the comic relief character in Bride of Frankenstein.
Is that her birthday today as well? Oh, happy birthday to her. Oh, she's great. She's so good in that.
I'm on staff.
Whatever it is she says.
But also happy birthday to documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney, who won an Oscar for Taxi to the Dark Side and directed Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and also the Scientology documentary Going Clear, which is really good, actually worth checking out.
Oh, Sarah Bernhardt's birthday today.
Sarah who?
Sarah Bernhardt was this famous singer and stage actress from the turn of the 20th century. I don't think she was ever in any films, though.
Oh, it's Meghan McCain's birthday as well.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay, do you want to recommend me something first?
Well, yeah, seeing as I was talking about it earlier, I'll recommend the film Violent Saturday. Have you seen it?
I've not seen it, no, but I will check it out.
It's really good. It's a kind of a Technicolor thriller. It's set in the small town in Nevada, California. I don't know, but it's somewhere out west, maybe Arizona, and it is it's about a bank robbery, but it's also about the community into which the bank robbery happens. And it's very good. Lee Marvin is in it, Ernest Borgnine is in it, Victor Mature, Billy Chapin, and it is a Brad Dexter. It's full of great performances, and it is a taut, like, it's a really solid, I wouldn't call it, go as far as to call it a B movie, but it has that slight, it's a film noir with drenched in color. It's a wonderful film and overlooked. It's a really, really worth watching.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Richard Fleischer's filmography. He's done quite a variety of movies. He did The Vikings with Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis. He also did 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which also has Kirk Douglas in it. Fantastic Voyage, Dr. Doolittle. Is that the one with Rex Harrison?
It's probably not the Eddie Murphy one.
No. Or the Robert Downey Jr. one, which is coming out soon.
Oh, Jesus.
And he also did The Boston Strangler and Tora Tora Tora, the Pearl Harbor film.
Boston Strangler is an interesting movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. That's also on my list. And he also did Soylent Green with Charlton Heston.
The film to which everyone knows the spoiler.
Yeah, because... Yeah, The Simpsons made fun
of it. Anyway, what are you recommending?
I'm going to recommend to you a horror movie, which I just saw recently, which is, I think a lot of people, when they say like, oh, there were no good horror films in the 90s before Scream came out. There was a few good ones. And that is the Bernard Rose film Candyman, which is based off the short story written by Clive Barker, who wrote and directed Hellraiser. It's a really, really good film. I think it has a lot to say. Tony Todd's performance as Candyman is amazing, and he's so creepy and just so good. He's like, he just has that same quality that Robert Mitchum had in The Night of the Hunter. And Virginia Madsen, who is one of her early roles, which she's fantastic in it as well. Academy Award nominated for Sideways. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing the new one, which is I think like a spiritual sequel to Candyman. So it's not like a remake, it's a spiritual sequel, and I'm looking forward to it because Jordan Peele.
What does that spiritual sequel mean?
I have no idea, but it's produced by Jordan it's produced by Jordan Peele, and I think that type of film with him attached to it, I think could be something quite interesting. Given
I still haven't seen Us. I really want to see that.
Ah, it's good. It's really good.
Well, I've got to go to work. The sun's come up, and that means the day is upon me.
Yes.
So I'll let you go. But that was really fun.
Yeah, it was good fun. And like we said before, do check out The Night of the Hunter. It is very much worth your time.
Yes. I mean, watch it again and again and again. Read about it. Enjoy it. Bathe in it. It's a great piece of cinema.
Keep this movie alive. Keep cinema alive.
Yeah.
And but also keep to the roads, stay off the moors, and beware the moon.
Right. Yeah, truth.
Sorry. Anyway, yes. You can follow us on Twitter at Holmes Movies Pod. You can follow me on Twitter at Fabricius91. You can follow Adam. He's the Northampton Dane. And you're also on Instagram as well.
Yep. Adam.h.f.holmes on Instagram.
Yes, you can follow our blog, which we'll be linking to in the podcast info. And you can also follow us on Spotify, SoundCloud, Podomatic, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And you can... did I mention the blog?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you can check out the blog as well. And you can also send us an email, if you wish, to holmesmoviespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much listening to us talk about Night of the Hunter. I've been Anders Holmes.
And I've been Adam, and enjoyed myself immensely. See you soon, everyone.
Bye.